Well, hello, Northgate. Good to see you. You're not here yet, but we're hoping that you show up soon. As we've been doing for the last couple of these, I'm going to stall for a bit, but I'll tell you up front that I'm doing that. So if this is a rewatch, jump to 2.5 minutes, and I will start promptly at 2.5 minutes. But this way, I'm not preaching to an empty room, virtually. And this way, you also don't have to have your time wasted by listening to me stall. So this is stall time. I will tell this story. Plumbing stinks. Hey, Lizzie. We had a backup in our plumbing yesterday, and dude came out this morning and is still in the midst of that. So I will make this disclaimer. I haven't really thought through what happens. Like, Leanne's not home. Hopefully she comes back. But if she knocks, or if plumber guy knocks, I'm sure you'll see it on my face. I'll just have like a, what do I do? Because we have to pay the guy still. But apparently in the 70s, they didn't have like clean outs available, or they didn't have to. So we spent most of the morning, well, I spent most of the morning on this, but poor dude had to climb under my house and find things. But he did it. So I love it. Kind guy. So soon, I think we're fully functional. He just has to like do some tweaky things. But these are some of those fun little adventures, bathroom adventures with the Larsons. It's fun. I wish I hadn't said that. That's the thing that didn't need to be said. But this is in that skippable part. So I have another 30 seconds that I think I can self-edit. So you do know we are going to be in Acts 18. I'm going to do kind of two chunks, 9 to 17, and then 24 to 28. These are two just really sweet stories. So hopefully we can cover them in our allotted time. But about 20 more seconds and we will start Acts 18. And then next week we start flying. We're going to do big chunks each day. I'm going to skip a couple chapters totally and add a few. Not add a few chapters, but add a few at a time. So here we are at 2:30, and as promised, I will start promptly. So we have Brian and Lizzie with us. Hopefully, some other folks join in. We're talking about Acts 18, and I won't give you a full summary of where we have been. Hopefully, you've been keeping up. If not, you have your Bibles. You can catch that now. Hello, Nancy. But we're going to start in verse 6. Really, what's going on here is Paul is trying to decide what's going on in Corinth. He's planted this church and he's tried to preach to the Jews, and they're just not like, some of them are buying it, right? But some of them are not. They've been particularly resistant and even blasphemous. And so he eventually just says, you know what? I'm done. I'm just going to wash my hands and my head of you. This is all this responsibility is on you. I am innocent. And so he just decides to focus on the Gentiles in Corinth. And that's a big move. That's something like if Northgate decided that we were going to move downtown and minister only to the unsheltered folk, right? Radical departure from what we've done in the past, radically different society and culture and norms. It would be uncomfortable, it would be stretching. But so this is what he decides to do, kind of shuffle off the natural audience and make a move toward it. So that's a bit of a challenge for Paul. And at the end of that first section in verse 8, we see that many of the Corinthians who did hear did believe, and they did become baptized. And so there's some fruit in the things that Paul is trying to do. And then in verse 9, which is really kind of where we want to pick up the teaching portion, God quickly decides to vindicate this move that Paul has made, right? By having people come to know Jesus. But even more than that, God comes to him in a dream. And it's red letters, so we know this is Jesus, right? This is Jesus speaking to his servant Paul in a dream. And it's not clear from any of the text that Paul really was like down and out, that he needed to be, to receive a pep talk. It's not that he was asking for encouragement, certainly, but there is a pattern for Paul when he comes into a city. It kind of like erupts with the gospel, but then quickly it kind of fizzles because we have these sort of lynch mobs that keep coming up and trying to chase poor Paul out of town. They beat him, they arrest him, they stone him, they think he's dead, but he's not quite dead, so he goes back into town. All this kind of stuff is on Paul's resume. But we don't have any particular reason to think that he's particularly frustrated or discouraged. But nevertheless, we read in verses 9 and 10, Jesus' voice to Paul in a night vision. It says, "Don't be afraid, but keep on speaking and don't be silent. For I am with you, and no one will lay a hand on you to hurt you, because I have many people in the city." And he stayed there for a year and a half teaching the word of God. God just decides out of his own goodness and out of his concern for his child, Paul, to provide some encouragement, to give him comforting words, to try to inspire him, right? Not because Paul's not already doing what he's supposed to, not because he's desperate, but because he wants to encourage him. He wants to pat him on the back. He wants to say a kind word. And it reminds me of how good people who know us well are at giving gifts or giving kind words. My wife once bought me a chef's knife. I didn't even know I wanted a chef's knife, but she did. And so she bought me a chef's knife, and it's like my third favorite possession on the planet. Just yesterday, I came back from helping at Second Harvest with a bag of snacks, not because Leanne asked for snacks, but I was at the grocery store, and I knew what she would want. And so you would have thought I just came home with a puppy. She was elated because I brought some cool pretzels and things, right? Like, I know what my wife wants, and I, without being asked, want to serve her. And this is what we see from Jesus speaking to Paul. And I think we also see this in words of encouragement, more specifically even than gifts. I have this. This is a thank you card that I received from a friend probably a year ago. And it's a card. You can see it's like paper, and I still have it in front of me. And I leave it out because the words in there are so specific to who I am, and they're so encouraging that, like, I don't want to forget about the person who wrote it, and I don't want to forget about those words. And so I didn't ask for a thing. I wasn't in a dark place when I received those things. It was good timing on behalf of my friend. And I think that oftentimes that's what we need, right? We receive this encouragement not even looking for it. And so part of what I want to challenge us to do today is, can you send an encouraging card to somebody? Can you send some words to people? Not because they're down, not because they're full of anxiety, and not because they're losing their mind in the midst of all this COVID stuff, but because you love them. Just like take literally a piece of paper or a card and use ink and write it. And you can probably even just drop it at their house if you don't want to spend the money on mail. But like literally just do that. Encourage a brother or sister, not because they're desperate, but because you love them. Make that the thing that launches us to encourage one another, much as we see God, Jesus encouraging Paul. And the second thing that this mood reminds me of is can we be people who, in the midst of all this uncertainty, in the midst of all this strife and struggle, can we be people who recognize that God has no doubt encouraged us in ways that we haven't yet recognized? And so I want to challenge you to do that too, to like take the next couple days and really be looking for ways that without your asking, without like your attention being raised on your own, just ways that the Lord might have just dropped little bits of encouragement. Because if our antenna is up for the encouragement, we will see it. If our nose is down and we're struggling, or we're just inattentive, or we're busying ourselves or distracting ourselves, we're not going to see it. And so the smart money says that you have the time now to see the things that you may have overlooked insofar as God's encouragements without prompting. Now, going on to kind of verses 11 and 12, it's important to recognize that what Jesus says here is you won't be hurt. You're free from harm, not free from difficulties. Paul's whole ministry is going to be just riddled with difficulties, beginning to end. So what it says is you're going to be safe. You're going to be free from harm, not free from difficulties. And in verse 12, another lynch mob comes, and they bring Paul to a guy named Gallio, who is kind of a governor. He's a proconsul, but we'll call it like a governor, a Roman representative who has authority to hear cases of criminal allegations. And so we read in verse 13 what the allegations are. This man, this is the Jewish contingent, is persuading people to worship God in ways that are contrary to the law. Now, I often kind of trivialize this, but this is a big deal, right? Like, we need to pause and recognize what's going on in first century Israel. Here's a group of people who have, the ancient Near East at least, this is a group of people who have been worshiping Yahweh in a certain way for thousands of years, and we have all this new stuff, right? This isn't swapping out pews for chairs. This isn't getting rid of hymnals and putting a projector on the ceiling. These are significant things, right? If we're going to try to convince people that Jesus is the fulfillment of all these prophecies, if he is the Messiah, that is a radical departure from what the Jewish folks have known to date. And so this is a challenging thing. And for them, this is heretical. This is a big departure. And in the same way that we look at our own lives and see the movement of Jesus change us, that same kind of radical reformation is happening real time around Paul and Peter and Barnabas and all these other folks. So this is not minor, at least to the Jews and to Paul. But then we read in the following verses that it is kind of minor to our guy Gallio. So in verse 14, it says, as Paul was about to open his mouth in defense to the Jews, Gallio said, if it were a matter of wrongdoing or of a serious crime, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you Jews. To put up with you Jews is not a particularly complimentary phrase, yeah? Verse 15, but if these are questions about words and names and your own law, see to it yourselves. I refuse to be a judge of such things. So he drove them out of his tribunal. He's essentially saying, look, don't waste my time with these trivialities. This is below my pay grade. If you want to come to me with something legitimate, awesome, I'll listen. But otherwise, leave me alone. I got things to worry about. And it reminds me of when I was a child. There are times, and you as parents would probably have this in your repertoire as well, where, you know, my brother would be touching me and I would just, Mom, Eric's touching me again. And parents are like, that, I don't care. You guys have to figure this out yourselves, right? Or I can hear him breathing again. Like these things are completely irrelevant. But to me as a 9-year-old or a 5-year-old, hopefully, these are life and death situations, right? And for the Jews and for Paul, this is a life and death situation. But Gallio's like, dude, I don't have time for this. Get out of my face. And so he dismisses it. And he sends them out, and one of their one of the leaders in their synagogue at the time, Sosthenes, gets his face kicked in. Read that on your own time. But essentially what's going on here is that Gallio is like, I'm not making a decision about this. I don't care. This, you guys have to figure this out yourselves. And though it sounds like it's just dismissive, this is a huge thing that happens. Because Gallio just dismisses it, it ends up establishing kind of a precedent for the church not to have to make these appeals, right? So if Gallio had heard this, what would have happened is each little kind of province throughout the ancient Near East would have had their governor be able to make decisions about, is this legal, is this illegal? And so you'd have kind of the speckled spread of the gospel instead of this kind of just blanket spread of the gospel, where because Gallio doesn't make a decision at all, he just throws the case out, the precedent is now set kind of ostensibly that Rome's not going to get themselves involved in these kind of trivial semantics in your own practices. And so as a result, that allows the gospel to just spread even more more radically, epidemically. So he basically just dismisses the problem. And as a result of that, for the next 10 or 15 years at least, Christianity has an opportunity to just spread because it is now a recognized sort of religion. It is a legal religion for people to practice. That's huge. If it goes the other way, if he even hears the case, it has impacts. So now I want to skip that middle section. It's 18 to 23. Don't care about that. I want to talk about 24 to 28 because this portion I'll apologetically have to just rip through based on just timing. But this is about a man named Apollos who ends up being huge in the early church. Apollos was a wise, educated, eloquent man. He's a good teacher of the Old Testament. He had somehow been instructed in the ways of Jesus, which we'll find out aren't 100% accurate. But we also know that he's from Alexandria, which is again, a huge town. It's like Rome, Alexandria. Those are the big places. That's LA and New York. Alexandria was known for having a lot of early heresies in the church, just where things got kind of wonky. We don't know where or how Apollos was taught about the things of Jesus. We know that he was at least sort of baptized with John, meaning that he understood that there was a Messiah coming. But what we do know is that he was boldly speaking in the synagogues. He was speaking with some accuracy, just he wasn't 100% on point. He was a little off. He was a little askew, if you will. And so it stands to reason that he had been working somehow or somewhat on his own, sort of independent of what we would call the Pauline and Petrine Gospels, right? The things that Peter, Petrine, Pauline, Paul, the things that they were saying, because he wasn't in those discussions. So here we have a man who is preaching with great passion and fervor and authority and boldness, and a little heresy, right? He's preaching and he's charismatic and he's gathering people, but he's preaching some things that aren't quite right. And so we see, as brethren, we have this thing we call communal interpretation that we really hope is an insurance policy against this, right? It allows us to make sure, to make sure that I don't just sit in my room by myself and come up with things about the Lord, but rather we ought to be shaping this narrative of who Jesus is communally. We still have people like this today, right, that are these heretics that have great big ministries, they're famous, they're charismatic, they're charming, but they're heretics, and what do we do with heretics, right? We burn them, right? It's like in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, what we do with witches, right? And it's kind of a joke, but not really. This is kind of what we do even today. Historically, it's exactly what we did with heretics. Just a few chapters ago, you saw Stephen stoned to death, and he would have been considered a heretic to the Jewish community, right? He doesn't have right thinking. He's saying things that are inaccurate. I think it's a legitimate question to ask what we do with heretics today. We don't literally stone them and we don't literally behead them, but we brethren in our Anabaptist roots, we got a lot of people drowned and stoned and burned at the stake and their heads cut off because we thought you should be an adult and decide for yourself if you get baptized. And everybody's got their story and their denominational heritage, but what do we do with them? What do we do with people that we think are heretical today? What I love is what happens in this text. Which is they don't burn them, they don't talk about them behind their back, they don't condemn them. Instead, what they do is, it says in verse 26, he began to speak boldly in the synagogue, and after Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him aside and explained the way of God to him more accurately. Now, some of the translations say is they invited him to their home, which obviously I like that translation. Because I think there's ministry that happens in the home that doesn't and can't happen elsewhere. It can't happen anywhere else. It can't happen in the church. It can't happen in a coffee shop. There's something about being in one's home, being invited into kind of this intimate gathering in one's life where ministry happens in just a different way. And so Priscilla, who, yes, is a woman, and her husband, Aquila, invite Apollos into their home, and they probably have some baba ganoush and some hummus, and they sit down and they talk about what is actually the case with Jesus, who he actually is, what Paul is telling the world as one who has met with the apostles and the disciples and has come face to face with Jesus. They don't write him off. They don't condemn him. They don't kick him out. And what we see is shortly thereafter that Apollos, it says in verse 28, was now one who was vigorously refuting the Jews in public and demonstrating through the scriptures, their own language, that Jesus is the Messiah. He is now coming in to say, no, he is the complete fulfillment of the Old Testament texts. And as I said at the beginning, Apollos becomes a huge player in the new church. 1 Corinthians talks about how Paul says, I planted seeds and Apollos watered and God made them grow. And he talks a little bit later in 1 Corinthians about how some people are, they are followers of Paul or Apollos or Cephas or Jesus. And this is kind of, these are the big leaders, kind of the coaching tree of the early church. These are people that discipled other folks. And what we see is, I don't know why that happened. Sorry, hopefully you didn't hear that. What happens here is we see that Apollos, because of this, because he was treated and taught with respect and he was encouraged and he was pulled aside and in the kind of the safety and security of one's home, he was taught right thinking. Martin Luther and a bunch of other commentators even think that Apollos may have been the one that wrote Hebrews. Nobody really knows, but everybody's kind of might have written Hebrews, but this is the kind of role that this guy played, and that is not the case if Priscilla and Aquila don't pull him aside, if they did in fact write him off, if they instead condemned him, if they went around speaking behind his back of how this person is not speaking the right gospel, Apollos doesn't go on and do the watering. He doesn't go on and have disciples. He doesn't go on and potentially write the book of Hebrews. He doesn't have the impact in the early church that we needed the church to have on behalf of Apollos. Instead, Priscilla and Aquila pull him aside, invite him to their home, speak truth in love, and they humbly invite and serve and teach and love him. And boy, this is a thing that if you think about where we are today, division and heresy, false teaching, it's out there, but we're real flippant with the term, aren't we? We just throw heretic around a lot. And I wonder how much stronger the church would be if our response to what we perceive as heresy was not condemnation, was not gossip, was not eviction from the community, but rather, hey, come, let's share a meal and learn together.